Caitlin, do you remember that time we tried to go karaokeing at a tequila bar full of 22-year-olds?
Yes, I believe it was last Saturday with all of our boomer colleagues after the Religion News Association gala.
There were probably a few Gen Xers. But yeah, it was an unlikely venue choice for a bunch of religion journalists.
Yeah, it had a Girls Gone Wild vibe, so it was a little closer to hell than heaven for me. Which is unusual with karaoke, but we maybe should have gone to that burger joint down the street, Burgatory.
And all the religion journalists rejoiced at the bad religion pun.
From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two Christian women reporting this week from Steel City, aka Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm Caitlin Beatty.
And I'm Roxy Stone.
I'm Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch. The State of Belief is a weekly podcast with a potent mix of spiritual wisdom, political strategy, and hopeful commentary. In a series of inspiring conversations, celebrating our diversity, and bringing us together to, in the words of the great James Baldwin, achieve our country. The State of Belief, where religion and democracy meet. Distributed by Religion News Service Podcasts and available on your favorite podcast app.
Roxy, what was the highlight from last week's Religion News Association conference? I mean, besides seeing me in the flesh.
And me. I was there too.
Obviously, seeing you and Jonathan was my favorite. And also our executive producer, Paul O'Donnell, of course.
We love you, Paul. And I'm glad we split that turkey sandwich. That sandwich was amazing. I keep thinking about it.
I always think RNA is a good time. Mm-hmm. And it's great to see my RNS colleagues in person rather than just as like head and shoulders on Zoom. Mm-hmm. And this year, our RNS's very own Adele M. Banks won the Lifetime Achievement Award from Religion News Association, which was amazing. She won it for more than 3 decades of covering the religion beat. So very well deserved.
The gala was definitely one of the highlights. Mm-hmm. It was held at the Andy Warhol Museum. Mm-hmm. We got to hear from Adele upon accepting this Lifetime Achievement Award.
I got a little teary.
Yeah, her husband and son were there. Mm-hmm. And I think it reminded me of how unglamorous journalism can be, especially religion journalism. But one of the presenters said, "Adele, I'm afraid of you." And what he meant by that was, you're so good at your job and your standards mm-hmm. are so high that you set an expectation of quality for the rest of us. And mm-hmm. it was also just really fun to hear her reflect on different chapters of her life and vocation.
Some of our colleagues from Christianity Today were there, religion journalists from the New York Times, from the Jewish outlet The Forward or Catholic News Service. So some of them are actually from faith-based outlets, and a lot of them are from non-sectarian outlets.
I really appreciated the range, kind of the multi-faith flavor, just this acknowledgement that you needn't be religious in order to be a religion journalist, and just the variety of religious traditions that are being covered by the people who are there. I think it was refreshing because I tend to be in conferences where, like, everybody's a Christian.
Right.
And this just felt like that it was more centered on excellent religion reporting rather than, like, sectarian principles or beliefs.
It is interesting to have these journalists in the room, that some of them are from religious backgrounds that are very different from each other. And then you have some people who are, like, very secular covering just religion because it's an interesting beat. And they're all in the same room, along with a life-sized Pope cutout, which was also in the room. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a cool conference where I always learn a lot. I hear a lot of different perspectives, which I appreciate. But it is very much a group of professional reporters who can sometimes have a lot of takes.
Yes.
We always have panels. And then the best part is always like the Q&A at the end when the journalists are like, "Just a minute, I have a question about that."
Uh-huh.
And I don't know that the panelists are always expecting that.
I mean, journalists are kind of known for like asking pointed questions. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to hold back. And sometimes the panelists themselves would openly debate each other or challenge each other. And those make for especially fun and spicy panels to sit in on.
Well, we did promise you all an RNA recap on this episode, complete with a few tidbits from the conference as well. As have been mentioned, there were a ton of great panels on everything from how to cover the Israel-Hamas war in your community, which was, as you might expect, a big topic of the day at the conference, and not without tension, as you might imagine. There was also a panel on reporting on caste in America and a panel on understanding Muslim frustrations around reporting Islamophobia.
There was also a panel on religion and food, where food was actually served, which was fun.
The samosas and baklava were very good.
We thought two panels in particular would be especially interesting to you all, our listeners. So we snagged the panelists afterward from each panel for a short debrief.
Up first, a panel on scandalous religion and how to go from rumors to sources, documents, and video with panelist Julie Royce of The Royce Report.
So what stood out to you about this panel, Roxy?
Well, as the title of the panel indicated, it's about covering scandal, which I think is, it seems like a sexy beat to cover scandal, like least of all because they're often covering sex. So it's kind of salacious, but the truth was that you kind of get from the panel is that a lot of it is like very tedious work. It can be thankless work for sure.
Yeah, it's not a fun job.
Yeah, you've been there.
Even though sometimes seems like it might be, but we believe, Julie obviously believes that someone needs to do this. And we caught up with her after the panel to get her thoughts on why.
Julie, thanks so much for joining us and for the panel earlier today. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
What do you say to people who I think say this, like, oh, this is just gossip. Reporting on scandal is just salacious. This is just like scandal for scandal's sake. How do you kind of respond to, no, this is important work and I think it's worth doing and it's not just gossip?
You know, sadly, this is the state of evangelicalism right now. Caitlin and I were just talking a minute ago about this Stronger Men's Conference, and they have, you know, a guy that used to be a male stripper, and he's swallowing a sword and licking it, and I mean, it's, you're like, wait, what is going on? I mean, I don't think you can blame, you know, the messenger for simply writing on what's happening. How do you write about Mike Bickle, you know, at the International House of Prayer, having these salacious relationships with teenagers? And then here you have Misty Edwards, this worship leader who's there and having this affair with Kevin Prosh, who's had multiple affairs that came out in 1999, and he admitted them and admitted that he preyed on these women. I mean, how do you write about that? You know, you read scripture too, and it's not really devoid of these sorts of things either. I mean, unfortunately, this has been going on since, you know, the garden. It needs to be reported. I think people need to know what's really happening in what I call, although it's, you know, was coined by Sky Jathani, the evangelical industrial complex. They're going to church, and I think the average person in the pews is going because they believe in Jesus, because they care about the church, and they care about the purity of the church. And I think Jesus cares about the purity of the church. I care about the purity of the church. So it's not the most lovely job to have to report on this stuff. But I don't think the onus is on me for just telling the truth.
You and other reporters at the Royce Report write a fair amount about issues of abuse, whether sexual abuse, financial abuse, emotional abuse among church leaders. And you're dealing with a lot of dark things happening to beloved people. And as I'm sure you've found, it doesn't always make you a popular person. So talk about the cost of reporting on abuse in the church and how you decide when to take on a story and when you need to back away from a story. That there must be a lot of discernment in that.
Yeah. One thing I try not to make a factor in the discernment is the cost, because I think if you think about it or you try to anticipate it, you'd never write anything. You know, when I blew the whistle on Moody, that cost me my job. I thought it was going to cost me my career. I had no idea that all these people would come to me begging me to tell their stories of, you know, what else was happening in the evangelical church. But the backlash can be pretty virulent. Mm-hmm. And I was saying in the panel this morning that, sadly, I think in our churches, people have been groomed to be spiritually abused. Mm-hmm. They've been groomed that if anybody says anything bad about me, you know, the pastor speaking, that's gossip, that's slander. You know, slander has to be false.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I'll just go back and say, what did I report that's false?
Mm-hmm.
And they can't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we use the same standards of journalism. I mean, the only thing is that we're applying these elements of newsworthiness to a very niche group, which is, you know, corruption and scandal within evangelicalism, and not just evangelicalism. Sometimes we'll report on the wider church, but really this was where I felt called to report. And we're looking at, you know, does the story involve a major ministry, a national ministry often,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody with impact,
mm-hmm.
all those things, controversy, I mean, mm-hmm. that's a part of newsworthiness, and we try to follow those.
It's a bummer that you're not running out of stories.
Yeah, right.
Like, you started the Royce Report, and I feel like it just keeps getting bigger.
And I never intended to start the Royce Report. Mm. I mean, that just happened because, you know, first it was people at Harvest who mm-hmm. asked, really mm-hmm. begged me to report. I didn't want to because, like, the whole Moody thing didn't turn out so well for me. But then after we reported on James McDonald and he got fired and all mm-hmm. the elders stepped down, you know, then people came from church after church after church. And you know what's interesting, Roxy, is that some of these stories did just happen in the past, you know, week or two or, you know, month or whatever year. But a lot of them involve things that have been pent up for decades. I mean, literally decades, like the Bickle story, 3 decades. The John MacArthur story. Somebody said to me recently, you know, shouldn't you think more about mercy? And I'm like, mercy for whom?
Mm-hmm.
Mercy for the powerful? Mercy for the predator?
Mm-hmm.
Is that who we want mercy for? I mean, because when I read scripture, it seems to me mercy is to be applied to the victim. And these are victims that when they tried to get someone to hear their story, mm-hmm. they were told that that doesn't matter or to be quiet or they were lied about or they were literally slandered to their entire congregation and sometimes put out of their congregation. God's heart is always for the vulnerable. God's heart is always for the one who's being oppressed. I mean, I really do believe this, and I don't want to, you know, make it seem more spiritualized than it is, but I do think what we're seeing, I mean, this is massive. It's on a massive scale where I feel like there is a move of God to purify his church, and, you know, I'm not the only one that's a part of it. I mean, your book, Celebrities for Jesus, was fantastic. R&S has done some magnificent pieces. I love the pieces on Dave Ramsey.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, those were fantastic. So I feel like a lot of journalists are contributing to this and mm-hmm. have been doing a really good job. And I feel like we're all about the truth. So, you know, we keep reporting the truth.
Yes, you're reporting on very discouraging things. You also remain a person of Christian faith. How do you do that?
Sometimes I don't think I do it. I think God has held me.
Mm-hmm.
I have been given so much, you know, so many people, and I've seen the reality. You know, they say, if you want to know what the counterfeit is, you study the real, right? I have seen the real.
Mm.
At this age, you know, I'm in my 50s, to like walk away from that,
mm.
that's hard to do. But on top of that, God has brought, like, you know, because we attended the same church in Wheaton for a while. I thought we would be there, that our family would be there for, you know, till the end of our life. Like, I mm-hmm, just assumed mm-hmm. I loved that church and thought that's what would happen. And yet there was a sex abuse scandal there, and mm-hmm. it has not been handled appropriately in my estimation. And we've lost trust in the leadership. So we had to leave. We lost our church. And it's been an amazing redemptive thing that in the aftermath of that, we found a whole bunch of other Christians that had been in a church where something similar had happened, you know, and some of them had been there 30 years.
Hmm.
And so I've lost a lot of friends mm-hmm. because of the stands I've taken. I'm not sure they were friends to begin with.
Mm.
You know, if you can lose a friend over doing what's right, then they're not really friends. But the community I've gained on the other side, mm-hmm. like we have now this little house church that is so dear to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in that group, I just adore. And to me, I feel like I'm rediscovering what church was meant to be. Hmm. The last thing, somebody said to me very early on, he said, Julie, because of the ugliness you see on a regular basis, you need to, almost as a discipline, just take in beauty. I am addicted to hiking beautiful places now. Hmm. You know how Eric Little said in Chariots of Fire, like, I feel God smile when I run. Mm-hmm. And I feel that when I'm in his, what he has created, and I'm enjoying it, like the whole entire time, I'm like, this is amazing. Like, I'm just loving it. I'm so filled with joy. It becomes a spiritual experience for me. Mm-hmm. You have to do soul care. You have to be in community, be in the word. And it's okay if you can't read the word for a while, too. Have grace with yourself when you're wrestling. And I think God has grace with us, but he has been so, so good to me. I mean, really, I learned that the root word of hypocrite in Greek means actor. And what these actors have done, what these con men have done, should not ruin my faith.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for your good work.
Thank you.
And keep on doing what you're doing.
Yes. Thank you. Same to you guys.
We will try not to be too mad when you beat us to the stories. Get the scoop.
The next panel we wanted to highlight on the show was a spicy one.
It seems like it might come to fisticuffs for a second. I mean, not really. These are all professionals, but it did get pretty tense.
But first, a provocation.
One of the best things that happens at RNA is that religion journalists get together and trash talk bad journalism, especially about religion. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of media that do not get religion, as we know.
And so, a provocation from Kate Shelnut, editorial director of news at Christianity Today.
The pastor wore jeans. This is one of my religion reporter pet peeves and something that always bothers me when I see it in the wild. I'm sure there are more profound or more meaningful critiques to have of religion reporting today, but this is the one that I'm choosing to focus on. And it really landed for me last year when there was a source, an evangelical leader who I'd interviewed and known for all this time, and he was getting profiled in a major national publication. And I got really excited to see how a magazine of this caliber was gonna like portray someone who I found to be really complicated and kind of like boundary crossing. So I clicked the link to open the story. And when I see the lead, my heart sank. Because here's this guy, he's so compelling. He has such many different like layers and aspects to who he is. And the way they chose to open it was that he's a Baptist pastor, but he's not wearing a suit. He's wearing jeans. And
Whoa.
They even, yes.
Jeans on a Baptist pastor?
What's next, tattoos?
So they even go on to say, if that wasn't enough, that here's a man from a different cloth. So there's also a pun. And it was so unnecessary because, one, he's pictured. He's the top picture of the story. He's pictured right above. So you can see what he's wearing and what he looks like and what his fashion is. But also, it's the 2020s, and we no longer need to be told that a pastor wore jeans. So I'm coming at this from like a reporter who's in the evangelical world and reports on the evangelical world. And I can tell you with good authority that it's a place where we pretty much all wear jeans. I guess if we rewind, like there would be a time maybe in the 90s, like emergent church movement, where wearing jeans was like cool or different. And it was like maybe saying like, oh, this isn't your grandma's church service.
I'm not a regular mom. I'm a cool mom.
Yeah. I just think we're so far past that now. I guess not every pastor wears jeans, but you're going to see jeans not just in like the extreme churches, not just in like a biker church or a cowboy church or a college church, but you're going to see them in like a mainline church and a mega church and a charismatic church and like denominational meetings. I'm having trouble trying to think of places where you wouldn't ever see someone in jeans. And I think that would
those
be like,
priests have jeans on under the robes.
That's what I was thinking. Even people in like liturgical garments. I don't know.
Yeah.
It just, to me, it doesn't say that much anymore.
Right.
To say that a pastor wore jeans. It hasn't stopped people from using the descriptor. Some of the ones that I have read recently are like, the pastor wore jeans and his shirt was untucked. Or he prefers blue
so
jeans.
So he was a slob.
Yes. To a suit and tie. Or his usual preaching attire is a t-shirt and jeans. The trope is so overused that I found two examples from a top newspaper where a pastor was described as wearing jeans and riding a motorcycle. One of them was Franklin Graham, and the other was a black preacher in Harlem. So it's clear that, like, it doesn't signal one type of person to be wearing jeans. It's just, like, so ubiquitous. We've got, like, Mark Driscoll wears jeans, and, like, so does Justin Bieber to church. So I don't know. These days, I think I'm wearing jeans now. Like, nice jeans can, like, qualify as so many things. It could be business casual. It could be something you wear to the office or a nightclub or, like, a restaurant. Like, everyone wears jeans. And I love a good detail in a story. I think clothes can tell us about a person, but not jeans. Mm-hmm. Like, all of us are wearing jeans. So could you imagine describing other sources that way and being like, she was a businesswoman, but she preferred to wear jeans. I don't know. One of the reasons this has become such a pet peeve of mine is, like, I read it as calling out pastors or clergy or church leaders as, like, other, like, it's newsworthy or significant in some way that they are doing something that we all already do and expect people to do. I see it, like, in the same category as if you said, like, he was a pastor and he had an iPhone, or, like, he was a pastor and he drove a car.
It conveys a total misunderstanding of evangelicals as being these completely other type
yes,
of people.
Like, you're surprised that they're, like, with the times at all. You expect them to be buttoned up in a way that none of us are still, or it would be rare to see that.
Yes.
We can do so much better than saying the pastor wore jeans. Before I'll end, I'll concede that there are, like, some times where I could imagine jeans being newsworthy. Mm-hmm. We know, like, the preachers and sneakers scenario where there's, like, maybe these are a $5,000 pair of jeans and
right.
we should call that out.
Because that is not universal. That
yes.
is actually super specific.
And telling.
And telling, yes.
And in my own life, there is a time where I met a pastor in jeans and it was very memorable and specific. This was former Hillsong pastor Carl Lentz.
Of course it was.
We're familiar.
Yes. And his jeans, I really think, like, showed more skin than covered. Like, the way the jeans were distressed, it was, like, all distressed and just, like, all skinny leg.
Wait, I have a question.
Yes.
Revealed skinny leg? Exposed skinny
yes,
leg?
That's
like
what I'm saying.
More leg than
more
jeans.
More leg than jeans.
They were ripped?
Like, it's, like, torn across.
Yeah, you remember those?
Yes. Like, you just see, I don't know. It was
well, if
lot.
He's wearing them now, then it's out of style, and that's important.
It wasn't now. I haven't seen Carl Lentz in the past 5 years, but I still remember it. It was memorable and newsworthy, clearly. So I would just say, if you must in some circumstance write that a pastor wore jeans, just please don't do it in the lead.
All the snaps, all the claps. I bet you can't name names. But, like, what's the most interesting thing you've had a subject wear?
So I do have an answer to this question. So normally when I think of or describe to people the way fashion could be relevant or the way clothes say a lot to people about someone, I think of the one is the Carl Lentz example on one far end. And the other example on a very another far end is someone who I met at another RNA in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia. And that person is Shane Claiborne, in which he
right.
was wearing pants that he made himself
right.
that were very large and had two pockets in the front. And they were big enough that they each had Bibles in them. So you could be wearing the Carl Lentz barely there skinny jeans, or you could be wearing Shane Claiborne, probably like recycled material pants, big Bible pockets. Maybe that's the spectrum of pastor pants that I have seen with my own eyes.
That were remarkable.
Did the pockets actually both have Bibles?
Yes,
that feels a little ostentatious.
I see it with my own
ironically.
Eyes. I think he just had to reference.
I mean, we love Shane.
Do you think there were two different translations? Like, just...
I don't know.
Well, the message.
We have purse privilege. So, I mean, he's got to carry
That's true.
His stuff in pockets.
That's true.
So
that's
true. I'm not going to shame someone for pockets.
I mean, if I was going to make my own pair of pants, they would have big pockets.
I'm saying what's ostentatious is to have not one but two copies of the Bible with you at all
and
times.
And they didn't say, like, Bible pockets, and he didn't say, here's my Bible. But I went and shook his hand, and I recognize a Bible. Like, I know what
you
it
is. You could feel it rumbling around.
I could know what it looked like.
We
didn't go thigh to thigh.
This is becoming... that a Bible in your pocket?
Jeez.
Yeah, we don't want to get Kate or Shane in trouble for
We've gone down a path we will not.
I've already gotten in trouble for this. I've shared this analogy before on a CT podcast. We got hate mail because how dare you objectify a pastor by looking at what he wears? I mentioned giving a pastor a one-up, which the pastor was Carl Lentz, because like it was like the boots, the pants, the leather jacket.
And he wanted you to do a one-up.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they were like, oh, I can't believe you would describe that. Like, you're supposed to be a Christian woman and a reporter. And I'm like, yeah, I got to take it all in. Well, I got to see what we're working with.
It's not like you went,
I mean, I'm sorry. And this is coming from the men who are like, no yoga pants on the ladies.
Right.
So they can just.
I mean, first of all, we can't help observing other people with our eyes, especially when we're meeting them.
It's my job.
Yeah. They're in part to notice how he carries himself, and clothing tells you something important about a subject.
Yeah.
And also, Carl Lentz is somebody who wants you to notice what he is wearing
or not wearing.
There are so many pictures of him not wearing a lot of things. I mean, I think there were a lot of stories were written about Carl Lentz with the lead. The pastor wore jeans. This pastor had tattoos.
Yes.
This is not your grandmother's pastor.
But then think of how many straight up nerdy, traditional, run-of-the-mill pastors that you know these days that have a Bible tattoo or another kind of tattoo and wear jeans every single Sunday.
Right.
Well, to me, what that signaled, like, I remember when Anderson Cooper did it, and God love Anderson Cooper. He's great. But I feel like all of these news outlets that did that, it just told me, like, it's been a really long time since you've been in a church.
In a church. Yep.
It was, or a synagogue or any kind of house of worship, because
it said more about the person reporting than the person they were reporting on.
And then when they're like, this is not your grandfather's church, I'm like, oh, so you haven't been to church since you went with your grandfather a long time ago.
Yep, that's it.
Thanks, Kate.
Thanks for joining us, for provoking us.
For provoking us anytime. And our listeners.
Stay tuned. Next year, more provocations to come.
And now, a shout out from the organization that makes this all possible.
Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
From Jesus's sandals to Mark Driscoll's scandals, Religion News Service covers it all.
Be sure to check out Religion News Service's other podcast offerings. We've got Martini Judaism with Rabbi Jeffrey Salkin, The State of Belief with Reverend Paul Brandeis Rauschenbusch, and Money Meets Meaning with Amber Hacker and Tom Levinson.
Be sure to send us your ideas for next season. We're already making plans. Shoot us an email at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com, and be sure to drop us a rating or a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. Hey there, curious minds.
Get ready to embark on a unique journey at the crossroads of money and religion with our new podcast, Money Meet Meaning.
The seductive effect of money, we think it can do the work that God does, because there's something about money that does that. It's wild.
I'm Amber Hacker.
And I'm Tom Levinson.
Tune in for a blend of wisdom and levity as we decode the path to a more meaningful relationship with money.
I think giving, and this is a little crass, but I feel like it's the ultimate middle finger to money. It's liberating to give some away.
This podcast is your gateway to a vibrant and thought-provoking exploration of the interconnectedness of wealth and spirituality.
Join us as we unravel the surprising influence of ancient wisdom on modern finances.
Faith pervades people's lives and our society. And because money is such an important part of people's lives, exploring that intersection of faith and money, I think, is super, super interesting.
Get ready to be informed, entertained, and inspired to transform your financial outlook with Money Meet Meaning. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
The second and spicy panel we wanted to highlight for Saved by the City touched on some familiar topics for us, but from a very different corner of the church than evangelicalism.
The panel was titled, Why is Eastern Orthodoxy Attracting So Many Young Men? Mm-hmm. And I think both of us
we're excited to listen in because we're obviously interested in gender and the church, as all of our listeners know. And we especially wanted to talk afterward with Sarah Riccardi Swartz, who teaches religion at Northeastern University. So we talked about this Eastern Orthodox manosphere, which I didn't realize was a thing until the panel. What about Eastern Orthodoxy is attractive to these men? Like, what are they looking for in it? And we also wanted to know why Sarah openly called out one of her fellow panelists.
What stood out to you on this panel, Caitlin?
Well, one, the manosphere is weird.
So weird.
I mean, we've already established that, but just it was such a vivid reminder of how many influencers are out there basically promoting patriarchy in the name of Jesus. I guess for Eastern Orthodox guys, it's literal patriarchy. But ching. But it was interesting to hear how this weird blend of hypermasculinity, patriarchy, and Christian nationalism is showing up in a different wing of the church. Obviously, there are parallels to what we've seen happening on the evangelical internet. But I think there was a real debate on the panel about how much these male influencers actually represent the church. There was one Eastern Orthodox priest who was basically arguing they don't belong to a local church. They don't go to church. They're kind of out on the internet doing their own thing. Therefore, they're not really representative of Eastern Orthodoxy. Like, they're fringe. And I think other panelists were saying, well, you have helped to platform a couple of these guys. So you have made them less fringe. You have brought them more into the mainstream. But also, whether or not these men are fringe, it is church leaders' responsibility to distinguish between actual Christian faith and the ways that these men are kind of warping it for their own purposes.
I mean, this is really, in the end, the same conversation, right, that evangelicals and other Christians are needing to have around Christian nationalism. You can't just say, oh, it's fringe, and fringe until it's like invading the Capitol on January 6th. It's not so fringe,
right,
that some of these people aren't sitting in your pews. A little pushback I heard was a framing of this as just a problem of Eastern Orthodoxy and not acknowledging that like this is happening in almost every religious setting right now.
Mm-hmm. But Sarah did helpfully name some of the unique or specific things about Eastern Orthodoxy that are kind of easily conscripted for this militant masculinity. So let's hear from Sarah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us after that spicy panel.
Thanks for having me.
So this panel was titled, like, Why is Eastern Orthodoxy Attracting So Many Men? Which some of the panelists had a problem with that question.
Yeah,
but
they did.
You did not. You were like, no, here I have receipts. So tell our listeners a few of those receipts. I'm thinking about, what was his name?
David? Patrick Harry.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Tell us about him. Tell us about these online personalities that have converted to Eastern Orthodoxy and that religion is driving some of their, might we say, toxic masculinity?
Yeah.
Or being folded into or conscripted by.
Right.
Yes.
Aligning with, perhaps. Yeah, we could say that too. So David Patrick Harry is a young man in his late 20s. I think he just turned 30, if I remember right. He is a PhD student in Eastern religions, esotericism, New Age religions. He was originally sort of nominally Protestant growing up, and he got into psychedelics and mushrooms as he went into sort of college age. He then sort of had a crisis of faith right before COVID hit and became Orthodox, and then he turned his really profitable YouTube channel into, like, all Orthodoxy all the time.
Oh, okay, so he already was.
He already was,
okay.
Sort of, yeah, online. You know, he has, like, 27,000 followers right now, which is not a lot. It's like a micro-celebrity sort of following online. But he partners with other men who have converted to Orthodoxy online. So I'm thinking of, like, Jay Dyer, who appears on the InfoWars all the time, Alex Jones, and he has, like, 100,000 plus followers on YouTube. And he's also a convert to orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing is sort of like this constellation of young white males who are interested in orthodoxy, becoming orthodox, having like social media followings, and then appearing on each other's live streams or podcasts and amplifying each other. And part of it is manosphere culture, part of it's conspiracy theories, and then you have it all sort of blended up with orthodox theology and practice.
And what is it about orthodox theology mm-hmm. and practice that is particularly attractive to them or works within their broader project?
Yeah. Well, it's wholly outside of Western Christianity. So that's like their first like big check mark for mm-hmm. them. But it also allows them to have sort of what they see as a militant or a masculine Christianity. So orthodoxy is very ascetic in its practices. A church service can last for like 2 hours. You're standing the entire time. There's like rigorous fasting seasons in the church where you're vegan with no alcohol and oil. So there's all these like strident practices that are almost militaristic in a way mm-hmm. that I think appeals to them and their need for sort of order amidst the chaos right. of modernity.
And like discipline your body.
Discipline your body, discipline your mind, uh-huh. and you'll be A-OK.
And not just A-OK in a spiritual sense, but you'll be an uber.
Yeah.
I dare not say ubermensch. That might be too close
well, I don't know.
To what we're tiptoeing toward. a kind of manly man, like right. a kind of man's man.
Yeah. Scholars would call this muscular Christianity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, and there's also this like a big push to work out. Mm-hmm. There was this one content creator. He stopped producing content because he went to seminary to become a priest. Mm. But he would always say, God is glorified in my workout gains. That was exactly what he would say. And then he would like post pictures of himself working out, right? And that's the sort of like idea is that, mm-hmm. you know, working out, being physically fit, taking testosterone.
Just as Jesus did in the desert.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Is helping you become the best Christian you can for the final mm-hmm. battle.
There's kind of the blending of muscular Christianity with this masculine self-optimization
yes,
stuff
absolutely.
That's happening right
and
now.
And that's like the crossover with the manosphere, right?
Yeah.
Like mm-hmm. you see that
yes.
Self-optimization language in the manosphere. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it's like it's utilized for Christian apocalyptic ideas about the end times.
I do have to point out, I think this was our friend David, you posted a series of slides that he had created.
Yes.
Things that say like reality is patriarchal, orthodox masculinity against feminism. And my favorite, a slide with a very strong man, shirtless, and it says, stop bitching, start benching, C.S. Lewis and why men need chests.
Yeah,
I don't remember
the
C.S.
Uber
Lewis
masculine
talking about that.
C.S. Lewis with right. his like pipe smoking and beer drinking. He was making major gains.
C.S. Lewis has been co-opted into so many like
yes.
he was part of the hipster crew, right? When they were all the hipster theologians with their waxed mustaches were sitting around drinking whiskey and talking about theology. It's yeah. like he was their yeah. hero too.
Right. Yeah. And Tolkien. Don't forget Tolkien, right? Yeah.
Do not touch. Yeah. Do not touch my Tolkien.
We won't. So I guess one of the people on the panel sort of flipped the question and said, why aren't women being attracted to the Orthodox Church? And I don't know if you and he would have agreed on your answer to that question, but what is your answer to that question? Is Eastern Orthodoxy attracting women right now, or is the question true that it's like mostly men?
So I think Alexei sort of like noted this a little bit when he said like feminist women are, I wouldn't necessarily say feminist women, but I think well-educated women who are slightly older, like my age, like late 30s, right, early 40s, are converting. Mm.
We are all slightly older.
What do we call that, older?
I'm an elder millennial.
Okay. We're all elder millennials, so you're in good company.
I think they are converting because usually they'll go to seminary or they'll go to get a PhD or a master's, and they'll be really smitten by the artistic, theological beauty of Orthodoxy. And they'll convert, but then they generally find parishes that are pretty diverse in their perspective, welcoming. And that's not what we're seeing with this parish growth that Alexei was talking about, like these vital parishes that stayed open during COVID. The parishes that stayed open during COVID are the parishes that are experiencing a lot of growth. And the reason why is because they were confronting the lockdowns as sort of a political, and that's right. what he felt to say, as a sort of political stance, that we don't believe that the pandemic is real. And that's where you see the sort of wealth of young men converting as well. And so when we do see women converting, it's much smaller numbers. It's a far different demographic than, you know, young white males.
So for an Orthodox parish priest who genuinely is disgusted by a lot of what's going on in the manosphere, would be very clear to say this is not real Christianity.
Right.
This is some weird syncretism or deviation. And these men are presumably showing up in their churches.
Yeah.
Like, what is the proper response from these church leaders?
I mean, that's a good question, right? So, you know, if you talk to priests, and I do a lot, and deacons do a lot of the catechetical training of people who come in who are interested. And I remember talking to one deacon in Texas, and he said, now the first thing I have to ask people is, are you okay with black people? Do you consider yourself a Christian nationalist?
Wow.
Because that's the type of people he's been getting who have found Orthodoxy through the internet. But most priests that I've encountered who see this as a problem, and deacons as well, they'll say quite clearly, like, this is not what the church is about. I am very, very fortunate to know a lot of priests who Father Tom on the panel might think they're progressive. Mm-hmm. But they're really honestly just living out the gospel, which they see as incandescent love. And so they would say, look, if you have these ideas about other people, you need to drop them at the door, because that's not welcome here. Mm-hmm. The problem is that that's not universal, of course, across the church. And we have priests and deacons who also have these kind of ideas.
Right,
And that's a bigger issue that I don't even think we were able to get to on that panel.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a tie to nationalism here, even though it's sort of not a Western.
Right. Well, I mean, Orthodoxy is nationalistic, right? You have like the Greek Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church. You know, unlike Catholicism that is sort of unified, even though it has its ethnic enclaves, Orthodoxy really positions itself as nationalistic. And that is appealing to people who already have nationalistic tendencies, even if they're Christian nationalists.
Are there a lot of evangelicals converting to Orthodoxy? Is that a big thing that's happening?
So in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the majority of like white Americans who were converting to Orthodoxy were evangelicals. Campus Crusade for Christ folks were a large number of that. Then you sort of have a lull in conversions in the late 1990s, early 2000s. People who are converting might be Catholic. They might be, you know, non-denominational. They might be evangelical. The 2000s and into the 2010s saw an increase in evangelicals. Like when I was in my field site in West Virginia, most of the people were formerly some type of evangelical. A few Catholics, or they were evangelical, then went to Catholicism, then went to Orthodoxy, right? So they did that sort of hopping through journey. But now it's like, it's all over the board, which I find really interesting. For example, there's a massive growth among Mormons in Utah who are converting to the Orthodox Church. I mean, so much so that they can't stop their building projects. Like they're running out of space in Orthodox parishes in Utah because Mormons are just converting.
That is a story I didn't know.
Yeah. It's a story somebody needs to cover because it's absolutely fascinating. But there are people from a wide variety. I mean, agnostics, nihilists. So I don't think it's just evangelicals anymore. I do think evangelicals are still a large part of it, or people who sort of self-identify as evangelical but maybe go to a non-denominational church or like have been unchurched for a while. They're there, but I don't think they're the actual like interesting part of the story anymore.
Yeah. You know? I feel like we could talk about this all day. So I appreciate you taking some time.
Yes, thank you.
All right.
Yes,
cool.
Thank you very much.
One of the rather timely and fun aspects of being with you and Jonathan last week at RNA was that we got to celebrate the release of our 100th episode together.
I can't believe that we've recorded 100 episodes.
I know. Well, this is 101.
Wow. Any highlights from the 100?
I still think that one of my favorite episodes and most memorable experiences was our first season, when we talked about whether or not we're still evangelicals, and we went to Washington Square Park and interviewed all those people and asked them what they thought of when they thought of the word evangelical. And we got a lot of crazy answers.
We should find more occasions to do person on the street interviews.
It was fun and unexpected.
We heard a lot of love from fellow conference attendees about our recent conversation with Krista Tippett. No surprise. That's going to be hard to top. Any lowlights? Just kidding.
Yeah, I have a few of those I can recall too, but
we've gotten better.
We have gotten
better. We have improved in so many ways.
Yes. Somebody recently told me they started listening and I was like, oh, what did you start with? And they were like, oh, well, with episode one. And I was like, oh no.
You're like, you can skip most of season one. We're still finding our sea legs.
There were some great episodes in season one. And the first one was a strong guest anyway. There were quite a few former guests of SBTC at the conference as well. So that was fun.
And we got to toast with them at a whiskey bar on Friday night.
Where the bartenders had handlebar mustaches.
And the cocktails were very reasonably priced, at least compared with New York.
Oh my gosh.
So are we moving to Pittsburgh?
Maybe you can find a man of steel in the city of steel.
Mine like a steel trap. That's what I'm looking for.
Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. Senior producer is Jay Woodward, and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. Our editor is Julia Windham.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look, and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone.
And Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening.
Something that rhymes with scandal. Rhyming scandal is going to be tricky.
To religious vandals.
Religious scandals to religious.
From religious scandals to religious fangirls.
Sex scandals to the sacred and the everyday.
From Jesus, from Jesus scandals to sex scandals.
To sex scandals. Yes.